This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's been more than a year since Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She offered a troubling account of a man who would become a Supreme Court justice, an account that Kavanaugh denounced angrily and tearfully. The confirmation hearings riveted the country, but what was happening behind the scenes was just as dramatic. Kavanaugh's confirmation was the culmination of what Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus calls a multi-decade effort by conservatives to control the courts. Her new book is called Supreme Ambition: Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover, and she joins us now in studio to discuss it. Ruth Marcus, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Ruth, we marinated in the Kavanaugh confirmation for a very long time. Some of us still haven't gotten it off of us. You know, our fingers still have that prune look that you get when you're in the pool for too long because we were waiting in it forever and ever. Why go back over it? Don't we know the story?
Oh, so great question. And it's a question that I had to address for myself when I decided to write this book, because did I still want to relive this? And the answer is twofold, and it's the reason I wrote the book. The first is that I thought, and it turns out I was right, that there were going to be dramatic stories, not just of what we saw on the screen that riveted us. It felt like forever, but it was actually fairly short, condensed period of time, but it was an emotional period of time. I thought there would be amazing behind-the-scenes stories of what was going on in the Kavanaugh camp, in the White House, in the Senate among both Republicans and Democrats, and with Christine Blasey Ford and others who accused Justice Kavanaugh of misconduct. And I was right. There were just delicious little moments throughout this book, I think. And the second reason, which is equally important, is not to make people relive this moment, but to set it in the larger context of why it's important. And the answer is, long after we're done with impeachment, whatever happens, and we think we know what's going to happen, long after we're done with the election, and Lord knows what's going to happen with that, Donald Trump's legacy is going to be the federal courts in general and the Supreme Court in particular, and the two justices so far that he's put on the Supreme Court. And so understanding how Justice Kavanaugh fits into that, as you said, decades-long conservative effort to cement control of the Supreme Court. Conservatives were frustrated for years in their ability to get this done. Justice Kavanaugh was their opportunity. They were not going to let this one be squandered. And that larger tale and the significance of having that fifth vote on the Supreme Court for conservatives is what really makes this story worth telling and understanding.
One of the things we learned from your book is one of the details about how Brett Kavanaugh went from not being on the list of potential Supreme Court nominees to being at the top of the list. Let's break this into pieces. First of all, remind us what this list was and why it was significant.
So this list was Donald Trump's, possibly there were a lot of unusual and innovative, shall we say, things about the Trump campaign, but one of the most effective was this list that then candidate Trump came up with. Every presidential candidate probably has at least a notional list of short list of Supreme Court nominees. Donald Trump did something completely different. He not only assembled this list, but he made it public, and he made it public for a very specific reason. Remember, this came up at a time when there was a Supreme Court vacancy that should have gone to Judge Merrick Garland, nominated by President Obama after Justice Scalia died in February of 2016.
And perhaps but for the fact that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said and flat out refused, we're not going to hear your nomination, he might yet be on the court.
Yes, and if I believe, and I think that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell believes and President Trump believes, that it's very possible, had it not been for Justice Scalia's untimely death, had it not been for McConnell's decision, an outrageous decision, I believe, to hold that seat open, Donald Trump would not be president today. And the reason for that is that for a group of Republican voters, social conservatives, evangelical voters, the Supreme Court is, and the courts in general, are a major motivating factor. And they had enormous doubts, real and doubts that had a foundation in his past about whether they could trust Donald Trump to fill this seat. And so when he came out with this list, he actually came out with two lists of shortlist candidates during the campaign. That really helped voters that Donald Trump needed to get over the hurdle and to get into the presidency. That really helped to satisfy them. But for Brett Kavanaugh, there was a big problem because his name was not on that list.
So how did he get on the list?
That is a great question. There were two reasons that he wasn't on the list. The first reason was that he had a Bush problem, in particular with candidate and then President Trump. He not only had been nominated to the federal bench by President George W. Bush, he had worked for 5 years at Bush's elbow, and he had married President Bush's secretary, who was like a third daughter to the Bushes. And as your listeners know and understand, the Bushes and President Trump do not go well together. Some of them had famously said they didn't vote for him. Donald Trump had run against Jeb Bush. A Bushy was not the kind of guy, and certainly not a swamp creature. Brett Kavanaugh grew up inside the Beltway. He was the son of a lobbyist. That was not the profile he wanted. But then Judge Kavanaugh, had another problem, which was those same conservatives who were nervous about President candidate Trump were actually a little bit nervous about Brett Kavanaugh. So when Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, who President candidate and then President Bush kind of designated as his judge picker in chief, presented his initial list to candidate Trump, Brett Kavanaugh's name was not on there because conservatives were a little bit nervous about Judge Kavanaugh. Most flagrantly, from their point of view, he had failed to strike down Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, as a judge on the D.C. Circuit. So he had a Bush problem, and he had a Bush problem with Trump, and he had a conservative problem with some of the conservatives, including Leonard Leo. And so the answer to your question about how he managed to get on the list was a campaign was mounted on his behalf, and one of the most effective people in that campaign was none other than the justice he ended up replacing, Justice Anthony Kennedy.
By the way, the Federalist Society is a think tank here in D.C., like a conservative libertarian think tank.
Conservative legal think tank that grew up and became the most effective organization to provide the legal, organizational, and with associated groups, financial architecture to make sure that no other Republican nominee would go down to defeat like Judge Bork was in 1987.
What was it about Brett Kavanaugh that Justice Kennedy liked?
Well, Brett Kavanaugh was Justice Kennedy's favorite clerk. He was one of Justice Kennedy's most successful clerks, went on to a very prestigious job and a stellar career on the D.C. Circuit. And Justice Kennedy had in mind from the moment a Republican president was elected, even though that Republican president was not a Kennedy-type Republican president in the form of President Trump, had in mind leaving. I tell the story in the book about an elite Washington dinner called the Alfalfa Club that occurred the weekend after the president was inaugurated, when one of Justice Kennedy's sons approached Kellyanne Conway and said, "No one was happier about the election results than my father." And Kellyanne Conway took that and reported it to the president as a signal that Justice Kennedy was inclined to retire. And the Trump White House did everything that they could to get Justice Kennedy comfortable with the idea of retiring, including naming another one of his former clerks, Justice Gorsuch, to the court. And at that moment of swearing in Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kennedy, and I report this in the book, asked for some time alone with the president. And he essentially communicated to him, okay, you have this list. You've promised to pick only from this list, but there's a problem. There's a name missing. You might want to take a look at Brett Kavanaugh. And lo and behold, a few months later, Judge Kavanaugh's name appeared on a new expanded list.
Now, this adds another dimension to Justice Kennedy, known as a swing vote. This is the same Justice Kennedy who wrote the majority opinion in Obergefell versus Hodges, which ruled that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry. Same Justice Kennedy.
Right. Well, there are kind of two Justice Kennedys. The main Justice Kennedy, it's really important to understand, is a conservative justice and a loyal Republican. but he was the swing vote on the court, and there were critical areas in which he deviated from and disappointed conservatives. Remember, Justice Kennedy was picked only after Judge Bork, who had been the icon of jurisprudence of original intent, was defeated. It was part of the frustrating, from the conservative point of view, series of defeats and missteps that prevented them from assembling a really solid conservative majority. But Justice Kennedy, on issues like abortion, on issues like affirmative action, on issues most famously gay rights, was a disappointment, but nonetheless was a conservative justice, and he wanted to be replaced by a Republican very much.
I want to talk more about the role that Kavanaugh has played on the court and about the confirmation when we continue with Ruth Marcus. Her new book is called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Definitely have to talk about the impact of Christine Blasey Ford and what some of your reporting has revealed about people peripheral to Professor Ford. We'll get to some of your comments as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are stylish, sustainable shoes made for life on the go. Carefully crafted from repurposed plastic water bottles, Rothy's are fully machine washable. Best of all, they're comfortable and have zero break-in period thanks to their seamlessly knit design. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges. You'll quickly discover why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes. Rothy's are available in a wide array of colors and patterns. Find your perfect pair at rothys.com/1A.
We're wrapping up 2019 on Pop Culture Happy Hour by looking at everything we saw and heard this year and choosing just 15 favorite things. Could be a song, a moment, a movie, anything we think is the best of the best of the year. Here are picks on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking with Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus. Her new book is called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. We've heard from some of you how this political shift on the Supreme Court affects you. Here is what Ashley left in our inbox.
The switch in the Supreme Court moving more to the right has brought a lot of uncertainty and fear, honestly, into my life. I'm a lesbian mom. I have a daughter who's about a year old. Also, I'm not protected at my job. I live in a red state. And the fact that I could lose my job just for being gay, you know, it brings fear and is sometimes unbearable.
Ashley, thanks very much for sharing that. And it is worth noting that there are many states in which it is still legal, or certainly not banned by law, to fire LGBT people simply for being LGBT or to discriminate against them in housing. And that's one of those legal issues that some hope will make it to the Supreme Court. So definitely understand why Ashley feels that this directly affects her. But with regards to Ashley's comment, though, Ruth, when she refers to the switch in the Supreme Court, I think that the Supreme Court has had a conservative complexion before. So what makes this push to move the court further to the right different than, say, in the past?
Well, what makes it different is that in the past, there have been a number of swing or swingish votes on the court. As I was saying, Justice Kennedy was a very reliable conservative, except in a few critical areas, and I ticked them off: abortion rights, gay rights, affirmative action. Those are the critical areas. And as President Trump has been able to add one very conservative justice, Justice Gorsuch, to the mix, and pretty much keeping the status quo with replacing Scalia, now the switch from Kennedy to Kavanaugh is much more significant, because on each of those hot button issues, it seems to me highly likely that Justice Kavanaugh will be significantly to the right of Justice Kennedy. And in particular, to Ashley's question, the specific question of the status of legal protections for gay, lesbian, and transgender Americans is front and center before the court this term. The court heard oral arguments and will decide by the end of June whether the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prevents employers from firing people on the basis of sex or gender, includes protections on the basis of sexual orientation or on the basis of being transgender. Those are two separate cases. There are questions about whether if you read the text of the statute, which is what Justice Scalia told his colleagues and lawyers to do, whether that would include those protections. But I think that the advocates for protection are a little bit glum about their chances there. So I can't give Ashley in a red state a lot of solace in terms of her anxiety, because I think it has I think it's well-founded.
Let's get back to the complexion of the court a little bit later, but I want to get back into the story of the confirmation, particularly the big storyline that kind of tentpoled the entire narrative, which had to do with the testimony of Professor Christine Blasey Ford during the Kavanaugh hearings. We remember that she described having been, as she puts it, assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were both in high school at a party. There were many parts of her testimony that were extremely riveting. Here's just one very brief clip.
I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life.
Ruth, you learned some interesting things about what was going on behind the scenes with Christine Blasey Ford's testimony, including interviewing some of the people who also knew her that, you know, may or may not have been able to corroborate what she testified to.
Well, the moment of that testimony was so searing because it was so real. In fact, she had not really rehearsed that opening statement before her lawyers. She wanted it to not sound rehearsed. She read it out loud to herself in her hotel room that night, and then again waiting to go before the hearing. And one of her lawyers said, "I'm thinking, now you're practicing, because we're so used. I think one thing that was so powerful about her testimony was that we're so used to rehearsed witnesses, and that this was a witness, and you can hear that in her voice, whose emotion was so raw. She really didn't want to be there. This is a woman who would get nervous at the start of her statistics class about performing in front of students that she didn't know. And there she was. She didn't even understand fully, or just didn't really take in the notion that this would be televised nationally and that millions and millions of people would be watching her. So the lack of rehearsal that she did, and she brought up those scientific words like indelible in the hippocampus that her lawyers had actually advised her to stay away from, because who could possibly understand that? But it made her that much more real.
Well, and it also kind of conferred some credibility in a way, because they were talking about her recollection of certain events and what that means. And because she had studied the psychology of trauma, she was able to say that these instances sear themselves in the mind in such a way that they're emotional memory rather than intellectual memory, but that doesn't mean they did not happen.
Right. And to be fair and accurate, there were many aspects of that evening that Christine Blasey Ford did not recall: whose house it was at, where it was precisely. So that was a question with her testimony. But as her lawyers told me, if you were going to make up a story like this, and to be clear, I believe that she did not make up this story. I believe that she related it accurately. But if you were going to make up a story like this, you would make up a much better story. Among other things, you would not put another witness in the room, Mark Judge. So people like Senator Susan Collins and others who said, "Oh, I believe because I listened to her testimony that something terrible happened to Christine Blasey Ford, but she's just mistaken about whether or not it was Brett Kavanaugh." I just concluded that that was a comforting thing they could tell themselves in order to seem like they were giving credence to her story without really taking in what I think is the overwhelming likelihood that she is accurate.
How do you reflect on the impact of Christine Blasey Ford's testimony in the larger sense of the Me Too movement? I mean, I think for a lot of people, it began to cement in the minds of Americans, especially I would say American men, that when a woman says she was assaulted, when she says she was harassed, default to believing her. Don't default to saying, "Well, how do you know? And who else was there? And are you sure? And what were you drinking?" Like, it kind of blew the lid off that and made it not okay to just kind of thumb your nose at a woman who says, "No, really, this happened to me." But also you talked to some people peripheral to Christine Blasey Ford who also could not quite corroborate the details of her story. So where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us in a very unfortunate place, I think, because while there was an FBI investigation, it was not an FBI investigation that was aimed at getting at the truth. It was an FBI investigation that was aimed at getting 50 votes for Brett Kavanaugh to be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. Because the FBI investigation was controlled by White House counsel Don McGahn, and who was Brett Kavanaugh's biggest advocate from the moment before, even before Justice Kennedy retired. He wanted to see Brett Kavanaugh confirmed, and he did not want to see an FBI investigation. And when an FBI investigation was forced on him by Senator Flake of Arizona, Senator Collins, and Senator Murkowski, he was willing to do only to ask the FBI or instruct the FBI to do only that which those Republican senators who were wavering on their vote insisted on. And the biggest person that they failed to interview did not know anything about Christine Blasey Ford, but he knew something about another incident at Yale that was corroborative or potentially corroborative of a second woman who came out in the aftermath of Christine Blasey Ford's allegations, a Yale classmate of Justice Kavanaugh's named Debbie Ramirez, who recalled imperfectly Justice Kavanaugh exposing himself to her during a drunken dorm room party freshman year at Yale. There was a man named Max Steyer, who is the head of a bipartisan public interest group here, ironically an interest group that's dedicated to promoting good government. And he recalled seeing a second incident at Yale that same year in which then student Brett Kavanaugh, accompanied by two friends, exposed himself to another woman, a woman who, it's important to say, does not remember what happened. She has told people that she didn't remember what happened. Max Steyer desperately wanted to get his story to the FBI. They wouldn't interview him. He desperately tried to get his story to Republican senators. They wouldn't talk to him. And I think that that was a dereliction of duty, because that would have been corroborative of Debbie Ramirez, which would have been corroborative of Christine Blasey Ford. And we didn't get to that truth, whatever it might have been.
Let's back up to Justice Kennedy for a minute. Marion asked, what did Justice Kennedy see in Kavanaugh that he thought would help the court and the country?
I think Justice Kennedy saw in Justice Kavanaugh a sort of younger version of himself, an attractive young man who worked incredibly hard on Justice Kennedy's behalf when he was his law clerk. Later clerks would tell me that Justice Kennedy would muse to them, oh, here's where Brett sat. He would be there when I came in the morning. And when I left at night, I would say, oh, Brett, go home. And everybody likes having people that they mentor succeed in life. And here was Judge Kavanaugh then, who had become a very well-respected judge on the D.C. Circuit, often called the second most important court in the country. And so he saw him, I think, even though he understood him to be more conservative, certainly, than Justice Kennedy, as a worthy successor. And certainly among the potential successors that President Trump could have chosen before all this information came out from Christine Blasey Ford. I have to say my reaction when then Judge Kavanaugh was nominated, and I had known him since he worked for Ken Starr in the Independent Counsel's office. I had known him when he worked for President Bush. He was a completely obvious run-of-the-mill likely Supreme Court nominee for any Republican president. So that was what I think Justice Kennedy saw in him as well.
I want to talk more about what this means for the court going forward and what this means just for our view of jurisprudence and the law going forward when we continue with Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus. Chris is in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Chris emailed, as far as Brett Kavanaugh, it seems that for a long time, it's okay to be a sexual predator if you are a conservative, But people like Garrison Keillor and Al Franken are forced out of positions for what might be much less serious indiscretions. I don't know Garrison Keillor's politics, but I know what Lindsey Graham said at the Senate Judiciary Committee that might corroborate Chris's point, or at least contextualize it. We'll play that clip for you, and we'll get some answers to Chris and more of you when we can come back. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bayer. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. Because someone with heart issues should still be able to have their heart jump with joy. Because a farmer using less water should still be able to grow their crops. Because someone getting older should still be able to act young. At Bayer, this is why we science.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
The chatbot on Sheila's phone is supposed to ask her questions. But when she starts asking it questions, it sends her poetry.
Secret dwelling place, mysteries held in the dirt. Time has other plans.
What happens when you treat artificial intelligence with love? On the new episode of Invisibilia from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with Ruth Marcus, a columnist for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Chris in Cape Canaveral, Florida, emailed, "As far as Brett Kavanaugh, it seems that for a long time, it's okay to be a sexual predator if you are a conservative, but people like Garrison Keillor and Al Franken are forced out of positions for what might be much less serious indiscretions." The idea about whether or not this was disqualifying for Brett Kavanaugh was, of course, the mainstream of the hearing. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, loudly expressed his disappointment at Democrats even leveling this argument during Kavanaugh's hearing. Here's part of what Senator Graham said.
What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that, not me. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking during the confirmation hearings. To be clear, Senator Graham referred to the Democrats holding this seat open. That is indeed what the Republicans did when they refused to even consider the nomination of Justice Merrick Garland, waiting for the 2016 election, which Donald Trump won, which allowed them to get two justices on the Supreme Court, just to be clear. But as Senator Graham said, he broke with his party to vote for Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. Definitely not conservative firebrands by any stretch. But these days, Ruth, I don't know if you see it this way, but it seems like the process has become so completely blood sport partisan that those days might be over.
Well, those days are almost certainly over. And that's actually unfortunate. If you look back at, for example, at the Bork nomination, there were six Republicans who voted against Judge Bork. There were actually, I may have the number wrong. There were a number of Republicans who voted against Judge Bork, and there were a few Democrats who voted for him. This kind of crossing of party lines is almost impossible to understand. It's become increasingly limited as the judicial nominations wars have continued and have actually just mirrored the rest of our political wars. And so and I think that the decision to get rid of the filibuster for judges has just exacerbated that. Certainly Mitch McConnell's move to hold that seat open made Democrats so angry that they were not going to consider seriously voting for any Republican nominees. And so the playing field when it came to people like Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh was very, very constrained. I want to go back and talk a little bit about the Me Too movement and the evolution, because I do want to quibble a little bit with the emailer. I do think that Democrats have sometimes gotten ahead of themselves and jumped the gun in terms of responding to allegations too quickly. You talk about how people should be given the benefit of the doubt when they come forward with these allegations. I agree with that, but I also agree with the importance of going through due process. I thought it was unfortunate that Senator Al Franken felt forced to resign before we could have an actual Senate Ethics Committee inquiry about what happened. But I also think that in this modern era, and this is a good thing, that conservative icons as well as liberal icons have fallen to these allegations. And some people looked at the Christine Blasey Ford hearings and the outcome and really despaired about whether these allegations would be taken seriously. I have to say, having lived through the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, having seen the much worse treatment of Anita Hill there, the complete inability of some of the male senators on that then all-male panel to understand the meaning and implications of sexual harassment, I think that we are limping forwards as a society in our continuing understanding of how to deal with these kinds of gender issues and gender politics.
Let me zoom out a bit from the Brett Kavanaugh story to talk about the Supreme Court more broadly. Justice Neil Gorsuch was on Fox and Friends yesterday talking about whether he lets his political leanings affect his opinions. Here's part of what Justice Gorsuch said.
The fact of the matter is any good judge will look back and say, I may not agree with this policy, or I may not have voted for that law, but the people's representatives chose to make that law. And my duty as a judge, when I put on that robe, is to put aside my personal preferences and to faithfully discharge my duty, which is to uphold those laws, to apply them neutrally.
That was Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch speaking yesterday on Fox and Friends. I wonder how you see what he said in terms of the philosophies that the justices apply today. I think justices who are further to, who are kind of in his political side might say, it's not our job to execute the law as the people's representatives today see them. It's to apply the law as the Constitution was written, as the founders saw it.
So I think there are two different strands of conservatism that justices and other judges have to deal with. One is the question of their partisan leanings, and are they, as the Chief Justice said famously in response to yet another President Trump tweet, there aren't Trump judges or Obama judges or Clinton judges or Bush judges. There are just judges trying to do their jobs. So one question is partisanship and what role that plays in justices' minds. And the other question is conservative judicial philosophy or liberal judicial philosophy in terms of methods of constitutional and statutory interpretation and what role that plays in justices' minds. And those are two different things, but the reality is that the I think justices do their best to try to put their partisan leanings and their personal preferences out of mind, but we still come up with conservative results and liberal results, and that is not a coincidence. And it's going to be really interesting to see this term among the many fascinating and monumental cases that the court has taken are three cases that involve President Trump and whether he's going to need to turn over his financial and tax records to congressional committees or to the Manhattan District Attorney, and how that I think justices in their heads try to do impartial justice, but it's funny how it all works out in a certain direction.
Before we go, I wonder where this leaves you in terms of your thoughts on the Supreme Court in general. I mean, if I was a chest-thumping campaigner for term limits in the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh would be Exhibit A for this idea that we take these nominations so seriously. If we don't get this person at this time right now, it's going to ruin the future for our children and their children. It just feels a little bit like, Jesus Christ. Like, is it really that big a deal? How do you reflect on all this now in terms of just the process itself?
It is really that big a deal. The process is seriously flawed. The stakes are so high. The court is so closely divided. And it is not a complete solution, but something that could seriously ameliorate the high stakes of these nominations is to make them more regularized. So one president isn't winning the lottery. President Trump likes to say, I think I'm going to get five. I certainly hope he will not, but he's gotten two. Some presidents get zero. President Obama got two throughout the course of his two terms. If we had 18-year term limits, for justices, that would lower the temperature a little bit, and lowering the temperature would be a very good thing.
Worth noting, by the way, the Washington Post did ask the Democratic candidates whether they would support term limits for Supreme Court justices. Andrew Yang said yes. A number of candidates say they'd be open to it. Michael Bennett, Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, Julian Castro, Tom Steyer, and Elizabeth Warren. Amy Klobuchar and Marianne Williamson said no, and the remainder of the candidates were kind of unclear or gave no response. Ruth Marcus is the author of Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. She is a columnist for The Washington Post. Ruth, sometimes history can kind of fog our memory of things and the emotion sort of takes over. So thank you for helping us clear away the clouds and just get back to the facts of what's happened. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This segment was produced by Avery Kleinman with help from Nina Rao and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, go to the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.